This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. The buzz around 3D printing seems to be getting louder. Industry experts say it could help spark a manufacturing renaissance in the U.S. Even President Obama highlighted the technology last week in his State of the Union address.
A once-shuttered warehouse is now a state-of-the-art lab where new workers are mastering the 3D printing that has the potential to revolutionize the way we make almost everything.
But as NPR's Steve Henn reports, as 3D printers and 3D scanners get cheaper, this nascent industry could be roiled by battles over intellectual property.
Not so long ago, a good 3D scanner that could create accurate digital models of objects in the real world cost more than $10,000. Then Microsoft released the Kinect. This video game controller was built to allow you to play games just by waving your hands.
But it turned out that the Kinect was actually much more than that. It was a 3D camera, about 1/100th of the price.
When it came out, Nicolas Burris was working on computer vision research at a university in Spain. But pretty quickly, he founded a company to make software that turns the Kinect into a cheap, high-quality 3D scanner.
We knew this could change everything, because anyone could just start scanning.
So last week, I asked him to show me how it worked.
I think the best thing would be to try actually to scan Lauren, if she's not moving too much.
Okay. That's Lauren Freyer, my NPR colleague in Spain. She was helping me out by recording my interview with Burris in Madrid, but she ended up becoming his guinea pig.
Is this a good pose?
Soon, Burris was walking around Lauren holding a Kinect scanner.
So I'm going to stay absolutely still.
Yeah.
And not even talk. Well.
As he walked, the camera collected 3D data and images of Lauren. His software began to stitch it together into a detailed 3D model, right in front of her eyes.
So here you see.
Oh gosh, should I fix my hair?
In minutes, the scan's done. Burris emailed me the file. And the next day, nearly 6,000 miles away, I walked into a tech shop in Menlo Park, California, borrowed their 3D printer, and printed out what I think is NPR's very first action figure. Justin Leathern helped me get the print going.
I was hoping that they'd scan her holding a microphone, but no such luck.
That's unfortunate.
The printer traces the outline of Lauren's shape, laying down a layer of hot plastic, just a few microns thick. Then it does it again. Slowly, Lauren emerges. And as I'm watching, I'm thinking maybe NPR should market an entire line of action figures.
Absolutely, why not?
It would be dead simple. All of this technology, from the scanners to the printers, is designed for consumers, and it's getting much, much cheaper. The MakerBot printer we're using costs less than $2,000. And 3D scanners are coming out soon that will be small enough to build into smartphones. Clay Lambert runs the Menlo Park tech shop. He says making perfect copies of physical stuff has never been easier.
We're at the point now with physical objects that we were at with MP3s a decade ago, right? Or even 15, 18 years ago. We're now at that point with stuff. I think it's fantastic.
And anywhere makers and geeks congregate, excitement is building. I ran into Bree Pettis last month at CES. Pettis founded MakerBot, which manufactures these low-cost 3D printers.
We're going to see more and more applications built that are going to allow people to be empowered to make the things that they want, just the way they want them.
Do you hear from other companies, though, that are worried about the problems with digital copyright and digital piracy sort of bleeding into the material world?
Pettis simply refused to answer the question. He stood there in front of the mic, silent.
So you haven't heard that expressed anywhere? You've never heard it?
But back at the tech shop in Menlo Park, Clay Lambert says intellectual property could become a big problem.
It's a huge question. It really is.
MakerBot runs a website called Thingiverse, where people can share their digital designs for 3D printers. And it turns out a lot of the stuff people are designing, copying, and printing off of Thingiverse, things like Star Wars action figures and Pixar's famous lamp, they're actually protected by copyright.
Yoda is not something that we can just copy and duplicate. Yoda is protected by copyright.
Mark Weinberg's a lawyer at a group called Public Knowledge. Recently, he's written two white papers on 3D printing intellectual property in the law. He says even when designers take a copyrighted object, like a bust of Yoda, and tweak it, it's still legally protected.
Yes, but almost the more interesting question is, how does Lucasfilm and Disney react to that?
So far, they haven't done anything. But the era of big companies treating 3D printing with benign neglect may be coming to an end. Recently, Mulan Arts, which owns the rights to the cartoon Tintin, served Thingiverse with a digital takedown notice. The company insisted the site remove several designs for printing out a model of Tintin's cartoon moon rocket. Weinberg says legally, Mulan Arts was well within its rights, but he thinks the move was a mistake.
The technology is coming whether you like it or not, and as a CEO of one of these companies, you can spend a lot of time and money trying to sue it out of existence and sue the genie back into the bottle, or you can spend that same time and money and apply it towards finding a way to use the technology to your advantage.
Weinberg says the kind of people who build and print 3D models of Tintin's rocket are the company's superfans. So he says instead of attacking them, Mulan Arts would be better off selling them digital designs to print, maybe even one for Tintin himself. Steve Henn, NPR News, Silicon Valley.
It's the last day of New York Fashion Week, and some cutting-edge design will be presented in the tents at Lincoln Center. Literally, in a way, standing on the runway will be computer programmer types rather than models. This follows an event that kicked off Fashion Week, something called a hackathon. Here to explain it all is Liz Bosselaar. She's the founder of Decoded Fashion, a company that brings together people working in the tech industry with people working in the fashion industry. Good morning.
Good morning.
Why don't we start by you telling us what a hackathon is?
A hackathon, it's a fast-paced competition in which graphic designers, software developers, and people with ideas, they come together to build an app in 24 hours.
24 hours. And in the case of Fashion Week, the fashion hackathon involved what? How many teams? How many apps came out of it?
We brought together 550 registered people, and 78 apps were created in a matter of a day.
Well, now the other part of it is many of the designers at Fashion Week are part of really big companies. So why a contest to build an app?
The interesting thing about fashion is that they trendset us, right? But right now, the industry could really use some innovation. They have kind of lagged behind in technology and how to run a business in a lean way using the power of tech. So we came up with the idea of leveraging technology in a very quick way to pitch them ideas for them to consider trying.
Well, yeah, I gather Fashion Week is a trade show that people go into almost just with pen and paper.
Yes, that's true. And what happens with the fashion industry, you have the designers showing their collections, you have the buyers placing their orders, and you'd be surprised that a lot of top brands, they use very little to no technology. And you have startups, like small companies, they're launching brands online and reaching revenue much faster.
I gather just as fashion editors travel to New York and Milan and Paris to see all the latest fashion, you, with Decoded Fashion, you travel around the world and see all the latest technology. So just talk to us about a couple of trends you're seeing.
So two trends I'm seeing that are quite interesting and growing very rapidly. It's 3D printing and visual searches. So 3D printing, we know that in the past 10 years, it's been used for machine parts, for airplanes. And now in the past couple of years, it became jewelry, metal. We see keys, we see rings being printed. In fashion, what's happening now, it's fabrics. And I think they're going to go to hardware, the buttons, the zippers, and consequently, more and more of this manufacturing comes back to the U.S. because it's very complex manufacturing.
Because it needs tech, high-tech workers who can do this. But also, what you're just saying is a dress one would put into a printer, which is really your own little factory. You put in material and it comes out as?
You can have a dress with no seams. You design the dress in your computer. You hook it up to the printer. You put the kind of ingredient, right, that you want the dress to be made of. If it's silk or whatever it is, it's so crazy to talk about it this way, but when you see it, the visuals are just incredible.
So the second one you spoke of, visual search, what is that exactly?
Right now, the search is word-based, and more search is becoming image-based. So we're going to see browsers, we're going to see websites that we can go to and add an image and be presented all the images that look just like it.
That's pretty amazing. I mean, considering you look at somebody on the street or in a store and you think, I'd love that outfit, and you can pretty much, as long as they don't mind you taking their picture, go find it. What about today, Thursday, last day of Fashion Week? What can we expect to see?
So today, finalists of the hackathon, they're going to be pitching to top fashion judges. So it will be a visualization of this intersection of fashion and technology. There's a lot of misunderstanding both sides. Like in the tech side, we keep building solutions that we think the industry needs, but we don't quite know exactly how the fashion industry works. And from the fashion side, they have these problems and they just don't know how to solve them. The conversation never happens. So it's happening for the first time. And it's quite exciting.
Liz Bacelar is the founder of Decoded Fashion. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Renee.
Here in Los Angeles, plus San Francisco, Washington, D.C., and dozens of other cities, there's a new way to hail a cab using a smartphone app to track down a ride. In New York, hailing one of those iconic yellow cabs still requires raising an arm to flag one down. The city wants to change that, but as WNYC's Alex Goldmark reports, that has prompted a lawsuit.
Since Mayor LaGuardia established the modern taxi fleet here in 1937, there haven't been many innovations in cab hailing. The whistle, and my favorite, the red light bulb on top of apartment building awnings.
Light goes on, it's on top of the canopy, cabs see it, they stop.
How often do they actually stop?
They don't, they really don't. They don't acknowledge it at all.
John Vell is as close to a professional cab hailer as you'll find. He's a doorman on Tony Park Avenue with the river of yellow cabs out front most of the day.
If I told you that you could hail a cab with your smartphone app, would you use it?
Wouldn't work. It's faster just going out there and hailing a cab.
But it may not be faster everywhere, and not all the time. New York taxis spend about 40% of their day empty looking for fares, especially in off-peak hours and outside Manhattan. New York Taxi and Limousine Commissioner David Yaske says apps are the latest innovation in hailing.
I think it will help passengers find a cab a little bit faster. For drivers, every extra trip they do during that shift is a material amount of dollars for them.
But that's what's worrying other hired car drivers. New York also has private car services. These livery cabs are more expensive and can only take passengers who call ahead first. Thousands of people already use apps with these cabs. Avik Cabeza is the head of Carmel Car Service, one of the largest in the city. He's joined other companies to sue to block yellow cab drivers from using apps.
You just don't go and reshuffle the rights that has been in existence for 40 years just in the name of technology.
Yellow taxis are a $2.5 billion industry here, so the stakes are high all around. Every edge helps. So lawsuit or not, yellow cab drivers are signing up for apps in anticipation.
All right, Abdul, can I get in your cab here?
Abdul Munir is testing out one of the apps, Halo. The company has been recruiting drivers for about a year now at taxi stands and airports. They say they've already enlisted 5,000 of them. Melissa Plout is a taxi driver who is paid by Halo to recruit other drivers to use the app. She shows me how it works in Munir's cab.
So a driver would have their phone mounted in a cradle near the meter, and a passenger would have this ideally on their phone.
It's a map. And right where we are, there's a cute little blue man with his hand in the air hailing a cab. I can move the blue man around, see nearby cabs, and with two taps, put out the signal that I'm looking.
It doesn't really make any sounds. It's not very satisfying on the radio.
It will. That is what the driver will hear.
The driver's screen flashes a big green button and an address. If he hits the button to stop the beeping like I did, the fare is his. The passenger sees which cab is coming and knows how far away it is.
And that thing at the bottom?
It says $1.50 off-peak Halo fee applies.
With 500,000 passengers a day, it's a big business opportunity. And cabbies like ours, Abdul Munir, are ready.
When they start, we rock and roll, that's it.
The lawsuit goes to court at the end of the month. Unless they're blocked, yellow cab apps could show up a few days later. For NPR News, I'm Alex Goldmark in New York City.
Thanks for listening in here at Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Jackie Leiden. On Thursday, Twitter lit up with tweets, of course, about finding love and then losing it. As they poured in, one program gathered all those tweets up and organized them into something unexpected, poetry. Ranjit Bhatnagar is an artist and the inventor of that program, which is called Pentametron, and he joins us from our studios in New York. Welcome, Ranjit Bhatnagar.
Thank you very much.
So this is pretty much fun. First of all, tell us what Pentametron is.
Well, Pentametron is a computer program I wrote which just watches Twitter, watches 525 million tweets a day, and it picks out the ones that happen to be in iambic pentameter. And when it finds some of those, it looks for a pair that rhyme, and then it tweets out a couplet.
Whatever made you think of this?
It was two different factors. One is I've been interested in playing around with the idea of poetry. I was kind of inspired by the exquisite corpse games of the Surrealists. And on the other hand, I'm a big nerd, and I was looking at the systems that let programmers talk to Twitter. So I saw that Twitter has this way that you can subscribe to receive just an endless waterfall of tweets from them. And I thought, wow, that would be really neat just to find a way to play with that. And what I ended up doing was combining my interest in the Surrealist poetry with Twitter's API, and Pentapatron came out of that.
So please, I'm dying to know. Give me an example.
Yes. Well, I looked back through the last day or two of tweets and picked some of my favorites. And here is a couple of couplets. That hesitation right before a kiss, I don't remember ever learning this. I've never had a Valentine before. I'm not a little baby anymore. And then there was this one that I found that's for you. I want to be a news reporter, yo. I never listen to the radio.
I'm kind of thirsty for a Valentine. My volume doesn't have a minus sign. It's a lot of fun. So how does this work? How much poetry does the computer program write every day?
It comes up with about 15 to 20 couplets a day.
Are there certain times of day where you find the volumes greater, that are more fruitful?
I haven't noticed anything about times of day, but I have noticed that during big national events like the Super Bowl or the Grammys, the volume goes up a lot.
And how about a couple more of these? For example, here's a couplet. I want the other Spanish teacher back. Someone actually said that.
Yes.
And you've paired it with Stingray, a double-sided Scooby snack. Boy, whoever wrote that, I mean, I want to get to know them.
Yes.
And are there any common phrases that happen to be in iambic pentameter?
Oh, there are so many common phrases that happen to be in iambic pentameter that I have a blacklist in my program because I got tired of hearing some of them. Actually, the very first iambic phrase that Pentametron ever discovered was, I've never been in Twitter jail before. And I didn't know what Twitter jail was. It turns out if you tweet more than about 200 times in the same day, Twitter cuts you off for a day, and that's Twitter jail. People say, I've never been in Twitter jail before a lot. So I finally got tired of seeing Pentametron pick it up, and I blacklisted it. Another example is, I want to see The Hunger Games again, which last year about this time, The Hunger Games was the big new movie, and everybody wanted to see The Hunger Games again.
Have you been able to analyze this any other way? I mean, do you have any sense of age groups or places in the country or where this information is coming from in any way? Obviously, it's English, so we know that.
It's in English, and it's hard to tell for sure, but it seems to me that it's probably a pretty random cross-section of everyone on Twitter, which means that I'm exposed to more different kinds of people, more different kinds of language than I would be if I just followed the people I normally follow on Twitter.
It's so democratic, Ranjit. Maybe Pentametron should be, you know, the next poet laureate.
That seems like a good idea to me.
Ranjit Bhatnagar is the creator of the Pentametron Twitter poet. Ranjit, thanks. It was really a lot of fun.
Thank you very much.
Flora Lichtman's here, switched hats again.
Yeah, sorry. Switching gears.
Switching gears, and our gear is our video pick of the week, and it's a real, as always, a real cool one.
This one, yeah, very cool. We're to the earthly pleasures now, that part segment of the show. it's about art. We went and visited the studio of artist Tony Dove, and she makes the kind of art that's sort of just my style. It satisfies my craving for fantasy and also my real nerdy, geeky side.
The Benji part.
The Benji part is well satisfied by the kind of stuff that Tony Dove does. She's sort of a multimedia storyteller, and she's been doing that, you know, since before that was cool, for like 20 years. Mm. And she has all this technology that she uses to bring stories to life. But her sort of standby is film. I think that she would say that, but the performances have a few different genres.
This is Science Friday from NPR.
Anyway, I think Tony Dove actually probably describes it best.
It's like I'll look at a movie and then the impulse will be to take it apart like it was a pocket watch and have all the pieces on the table and then think about different ways it can be configured.
So what does it mean to take a movie apart like a pocket watch? Let me try to paint you a picture. So what she does is that she has multiple projection screens going at once, and some of these screens are actually 3D in a kind of analog way. Right. They have multiple layers, and so you get this 3D effect, and they move, they can come down from the ceiling. And then there are these other projectors that have digital puppets, are what she calls them. And basically, they're these pictures of people or characters that appear on these screens, but they're animated by real people, and the way that it's done is through motion sensing software and voice recognition. So there's a real person who's talking and moving their arms in kind of a sign language-y dance, and that translates to the movement of these digital puppets on the screen.
Wow.
You have to see it. It's really cool.
And that's why we made a video out of it. That's why Flora went down to the studio and spoke with her and got a great tour. And if you want to see, it's hard to picture. That's why it's a video. It's hard to picture.
Yeah,
go
sorry.
To our website at sciencefriday.com. It's our video pick of the week. And it's up there, and then you can watch it. And it's fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, she also makes robots, and there are cyborgs, and there are opera singers. And the performances themselves include sort of all of these things at once. So there's multiple screens, and then there are performers on stage. And her next production, Lucid Possession, premieres in April in Brooklyn. You can get details. But if it sounds really out there, I think Tony Dove, you know, would argue that that it actually kind of mirrors modern life.
That sense of fluid movement across different dimensions that happens in the piece is something that we're exploring in the way we live. We are simultaneously navigating virtual spaces, social spaces, mobile phone spaces, and that gives us a sense of extruded identity, I think.
And extruded identity is really, I think, what this latest piece, Lucid Possession, is about. Mm-hmm. It was a nice visual representation of, I think, this feeling we all have where we're, you know, on Twitter and on Facebook and in real life sometimes, the radio, you know,
right.
A visual representation of that feeling of being spread out over different platforms.
Yeah. It's our video pick of the week up there on our website at sciencefriday.com. You can also see it on YouTube. And it's up there right now. It's a very interesting video.
I also would like to make a note for our photographers out there. And we have so many great photographers. Our annual Winter Nature Photo Contest is back.
Yay!
Last year, you warmed our frosty hearts with your submissions. Bundle up. Take your best shot. Send it our way. The contest starts at 4 p.m. today, and you can go to our website for info on how to submit your photo.
So it could be a picture of anything having to do with nature.
Winter nature.
It could be snow. It could be whatever it is. We don't set the limits on what it can be, but it's just winter nature related.
Remember last year's?
Yeah.
We had really wonderful photographers in our audience. I can't wait to see what they come up
with
this
year. And they send dozens and dozens of pictures in, and they're all gorgeous. And then, you know.
Then we'll see them, and we'll display them.
Annette, we'll put them up on the website.
That's right.
It'll be great. Thank you.
Thanks, Ira.
What a day we've had today tracking the asteroids, talking about what the meteorites and the meteors that hit Russia today. And I want to thank everybody who was involved in the coverage all around the world. Thank you very much for helping us with our live coverage today. Our program's senior producer is Annette Heiss. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our correspondent and managing editor for video. Our associate senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Luis Quevedo, our Spanish language producer. Denise Chow, our associate producer. Sam Flato, our production assistant. Neil Rauch, our technical director. Spinning the dials here in New York, ably assisted by Manoli Weatherall. If you missed any part of the program or you'd like to hear it again, subscribe to our podcast, audio and video. You can also go to our website and listen to it there. And you can also download our iTunes and Android apps and take it along with you. And any other way that you'd like to listen, we're available. Also on Facebook. Join us on Facebook. We're tweeting all week at SciFry. And also, you can send us mail, Science Friday, for West 43rd Street, room 306, New York, New York, 10036. I'm Ira Flato in New York.
It sounds like something out of a spy movie.
You lost the drive containing the identity of every agent embedded in terrorist organizations across the globe.
I bet James Bond wishes he'd burned those electronic files. And with the new iPhone app called Silent Circle, Agent 007 could have done just that. John Callis is one of the people who developed the app. He says the idea is pretty simple.
It's a timer, so you can say 1 hour. 7 minutes, whatever.
It's called a burn notice. When the time's up, the text is erased from both the sender and the receiver's phones. Callis and his business partners got the idea after hearing an all-too-familiar story. A friend of theirs had inadvertently read a text meant for someone else.
The person who told us this said it made them think that this colleague of theirs was careless with the things that they were talking about in private, and said, couldn't you just make it so that when I send someone something, it only lasts for 10 or 15 minutes?
Well, they did it. For $20 a month, anyone with an iPhone or an Android can subscribe. They'll also encrypt your calls and texts so that they can't be hacked, tapped, or otherwise tampered with. It works on video chats and documents, too. Because Callis says our phones hold very personal data.
We do use texts, we use phone calls for very intimate things that we don't want to have to justify later.
But what if the bad guys get the app? Some users may use the app to skirt the authorities, but Callis says that's not a reason to keep the technology from the rest of us. He says there are too many cases of law-abiding citizens being spied on.
It happens all the time. We've seen what went on with the News of the World scandals in the UK. We've seen things nearly every few weeks where there's some privacy scandal.
So, John, I'm thinking that maybe you've gotten a phone call from the FBI and they're not entirely happy about this?
Well, we have gotten phone calls from the FBI, and they said, "Oh, this is very interesting. How much is it? We'd like to think about subscribing."
But outside of doing business, Silent Circle's leadership has emphatically said that they won't turn over any information to law enforcement. Some people think that agencies like the FBI won't ignore this app for long.
You know, it's the future of communication, so they really have to respond somehow.
That's Ryan Gallagher. He writes about surveillance and privacy issues for Slate.com. He thinks governments will view apps like this as a security threat and possibly try to regulate them.
I do think there will be some sort of backlash against this kind of technology because it's a kind of power struggle and it's about control, and governments seem to always want more control. They don't want less control.
Right now, the customers are in control. As long as both parties have the app, any data sent between them will be secure. Silent Circle doesn't even have the keys that unlock the communications. John Callis says that's by design.
We are kind of like a department that takes sealed envelopes and delivers them from one to another. We've made it so that we can't open up the envelopes. Only you and your partner can do that.
Silent Circle set up their servers in Canada, a country with more privacy-friendly laws than the U.S. So for now, at least, as long as you're in the circle, your information is silent and safe. By the way, if you want to check out SilentCircle.com, their visitor log is burned every 7 days, so no one will ever know that you were there.